Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 18 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and the different guests go through the 1973 cult horror classic The Wicker Man once in a time. I am joined on this week's episode by Dr. Wickham Clayton. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to be on. And so yeah, this is episode 18 and the final episode where I'll be doing the full dive through of each scene in the film. And so with this section of the film, following on from the last one with Lord Summerisle giving the order to light the Wicker Man on fire, we see the Wicker Man start to burn. The residents of Summerisle start singing the song Summer is Coming In to, like, as their celebration of watching animals and Sergeant Howie burning to death. You see Howie inside the Wicker Man first trying to, might have drowned out the song of the residents of Summerisle by singing Psalm 23. And then we see him curled up in the Wicker Man doing a private prayer to try and, in his mind, save himself from hell and direct himself to the arms of God. And then, you know, going outside, we see the Wicker Man burn, the head fall off to reveal the sunset, and the end credits of the film ending by going back right to the start of the film with the shot of Noir, the God of the Sun. And so before we dive into the discussion of the film, Wickham, what are your general thoughts and history on the film?
Well, I am a huge fan of the film, actually. I've just sort of finished writing the BFI Film Classics Guide to this movie, which is hopefully going to be out next year. So within the last year, I've seen it at least 10 times already. I first came across it in 2002. I was in London doing an MA in cinema studies, and there was this friend of mine that I was staying with. Her name's Neve, and you know, she found out that I really liked horror films, and she said, "Oh, you know, have you seen The Wicker Man?" And I said, "No, I haven't seen that yet." And she was like, "Well, you got to see it." And this is like one of the first videotapes that came out after that, like, late '90s renaissance. And she was like, "Yeah, let's watch this," and it completely floored me. I loved it. And ever since then, well, certainly for that following year, I watched it loads, and I keep coming back to it very, very regularly. I like it a lot, and in fact, when I pitched the book to the publisher, it was sort of as a fan of The Wicker Man, as opposed to, like, somebody that was, you know, really into folk horror, which is quite big at the moment. I had to catch up with a lot of the folk horror stuff that gives context to this movie, but it is just a tremendous film that I love coming back to whenever I can.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same way. So you mentioned, like, watching it, like, first time in 2002, and yeah. This is always a question I find interesting. We've talked about different guests on, is which version are you more familiar with? Is it the theatrical cut, the director's cut, or the final cut?
Well, I've seen all three of them more times than I can count. But I personally, I have a very strong love for the theatrical cut because it's so messy. It almost feels like it shouldn't work, but the fact that it just does makes me enjoy it every time all the more. But I have seen the director's cut a few times, which is fun as this, like, kind of artifact of curiosity, I guess. In fact, I've got the original US VHS tape that they took all that footage from, so occasionally I'll pop that on just to watch it, like, with a consistent
video quality.
Yeah, that's it. And then, yeah, the final cut I've seen several times since it came out, including just a few weeks ago. They did that the sort of 4K screenings at Solstice last month. So, yeah, I've been to that as well.
So, yeah, I went to one of that 4K screening as well. And, yeah, even with, like, the 4K screening, you can still notice the difference in image quality between the scenes that were cut out for the theatrical version and the ones that were kept in.
Yeah, totally. I think that was, like, the footage that they found was from like maybe a 16 millimeter print or something that they had to splice in with the other, and it had been like stored so badly and kind of washed out. So it's better than the spliced in VHS stuff. But there is this very clear difference between the two like bits of footage.
For me personally, I feel like my preferred version is the final cut, and that's the version that I've been focusing on in this podcast. And to me, like you mentioned, like the bit of the messiness of the theatrical gives that bit of charm for you. For me, I have that bit of charm from the difference in image quality. It gives it that bit of a rougher feel to it that makes it a bit more endearing to me.
Yeah, like sort of that almost patchiness of it, but while still feeling like a smooth story. Because it's so much more, like that final cut is so much more symmetrical in terms of storytelling. Like it just has this much smoother arc to it. But yeah, those sort of like cuts and splices and changes like almost give it a sort of a handmade quality that I really like.
Feels a bit grungy with that difference in image quality. I mean, that's kind of the image quality. You'd seen something like, say, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or...
Yes, yeah.
That kind of unsettling feel coming from the image quality rather than...
Yeah, like it almost feels like the film's been drugged through a swamp before chucking it right onto a projector.
And yeah, like I know that it's like some directors have tried to like replicate that style intentionally. Like I know when Edgar Wright did his trailer don't for Grindhouse, the film reel dragged around the car park.
Sure. Yeah.
To make it look like it being deliberately neglected. And it shows how you can get that bit of extra power from poorer image quality.
Yes, yeah, because like there's something about the feeling that film was there, and it's like the film has a history, whereas like a digital, a digital file doesn't like have that physical history
tactility.
There with. Yeah.
Like it's kind of one of the reasons why I kind of do prefer watching things projected on film rather than digital.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first times I ever saw it projected, it was kind of on my own steam. I was working at an independent cinema as both a manager and a projectionist. Unfortunately, we didn't have like a film print. But this was during that period where 35mm was still like the standard. But we did have one digital projector that was hooked up to a DVD player. So I sort of smuggled in my DVD of the Wicker Man and watched it like after hours one night. So yeah, it's at the very least the 4K helps to show the quality of the film a bit better. But I really would love to actually see a proper 35mm print of it projected. That'd be, incredible.
I mean, everyone where I've seen in the history of the film, all the actual quality of the film, the actual footage and the footage of it, I think definitely in terms of actual film reel, probably never find a complete 35mm reel of the film as originally intended.
Oh, no, of course.
And Robin Hardy, Anthony Schaefer. But given that for the longest time, I thought that a lot of that footage was lost forever. Rather have it in poor quality than it not existing at all.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they sort of printed off a couple of 35mm prints of the final cut, like right around 2013, just to like show at the BFI or whatever. As you say, like an imperfect version of it's way, preferable to no version.
And so, yeah, actually diving into this particular section of the film, and starting with this section of the film, and if you listen to this podcast, I'm sounding like a broken record on it. The first thing I want to highlight is the music, and...
Yes.
Because... Again, the work of Paul Giovanni here is such a good job at building the atmosphere and tone of the film.
And God, it's incredible, yeah.
Here, it works really well as the contrast, as we've got the horrific imagery and sounds of the Wicker Man burning, all the animals screaming in pain. contrasted with the residents of somewhere else singing this, you know, summaries are coming in, and that celebratory song is for them bringing in the summer and the harvest. And in some ways, you also feel as them trying to drown out the screams of their singing.
And Giovanni's version is brilliant because it even contrasts with the original version of the song. I don't know if you know the traditional version, but it's actually sung in a round. So somebody will sing like one phrase, and then the next person will come in with the first phrase, and it'll sort of sing over and over. And it's actually like really upbeat and sort of major key. So it's sort of like, summer is a coming in, loudly sing cuckoo, instead of like what we have here, which is almost this funeral dirge, which is in a minor key. It's like completely at odds with what that song is supposed to sound like. And on top of that, yeah, like the whole sort of setup of the story is this battle between, you know, the kind of the pagans, who for the most part you're kind of on the side of, except when they're sort of suspicious with having possibly kidnapped or killed a young girl, and Howie, who's a total jerk to them the entire time, except he's trying to save this young girl. But like that final conflict actually plays out through music. So, like, in this interview, apparently, well, somebody said that Robin Hardy claimed that it was originally a musical. Like, he saw it as a musical. And, like, that's where you see it the most, where these two bits of singing are actually battling it out with each other. And, of course, the summer is a-coming in is louder than Howie singing. The animals are louder than him. And, like, the sound of the burning wicker man's louder than all of it by the end. So yeah, like all of those levels of conflict and battle just sort of like play out just over the soundtrack.
And yeah, also I think like it also works with actually this song in terms of when it was written, because when I was doing my like in high school, so music was one of the courses that was that year 7 and 8, and we were talking about folk music. One of the things that songs that was first brought up was Summer Is Coming In. And it's one of the songs that is, you know, one that's thought of as traditional British folk music. And given the inspiration that Paul Giovanni has taken from different sorts of folk music throughout his composition for The Wicker Man, it feels fitting that this is how the film ends.
Yes, yeah, totally. For a film that in so many ways is kind of like, you know, as we said, sort of like a bit sloppy and handmade, like this ending feels absolutely perfect, which is probably why it was never sort of changed, or like alternate cuts of it were sort of introduced in later cuts. Like this ending is absolutely necessary to hold the entire thing together. So even that like butchered theatrical cut works because this ending fits it all together perfectly.
Yeah, then they also like mentioned the like that contrast between like the folk music and how he's singing. And also interesting, like the one that Howie sings being Psalm 23.
Yes.
And it is one where, you know, I've seen it used like a fair few times in films and TV. Like it's used fairly prominently in The Elephant Man. It's used the opening theme music for The Vicar of Dibley. But also does feel especially fitting here, because like the way the song, like the psalm is played, like the lay down in green pastures, Lord and the Shepherd, it feels fitting as a song for like the acceptance of death. And example, like other films have used it in that way. So I'm off the top of my head, I think of the animated film When the Wind Blows, and that's one of the things they use at the very end of the film to signify the deaths of the of the two main characters in that.
Yeah.
And it's one that's, it works really well as that bit of contrast with the rest of Summer Isle.
But that's also the hymn that they're singing at the beginning of the film in church.
Yeah.
You know, going with the final cut. So again, like, I said earlier, it's the final cut has this symmetry that's a lot smoother than the earlier cuts. And that's one of the many things. Like, they both are sort of, like, beginning and ending with religious services. They both have that song in them. And they both begin and end with that, like, Nuada icon, you know. So, yeah, again, like, this is sort of, like, that final cut and that sort of ending with the Nuada icon, as well as, yeah, these religious celebrations and services, the repetition of that song. Like, it all, like, ties the film together really neatly in this in the latest cut.
Yeah, and then you also see that with the sense of community that's built around the song. It's like in the, you know, the opening scene in the final cut, you get, you know, the full church congregation singing Psalm 73, and you can't really identify Edward Woodward's voice in that. You'd have to really be paying careful attention to it. Otherwise, it just blends in with, you know, the other members of the congregation. As here, we see it in, you know, full powers. As said, he's like trying to battle with versus the samurai with his singing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he also like does a bit of a sermon in both. So you know, like right before this clip, you know, he's you know saying, you know, and lo, it is the Lord that hath laid waste your orchards. So he's like, he's preaching to them before they sing. Again, at the beginning, he does they do the singing before he preaches. So it, yeah, it's just like really neatly matching up. But there is this like sense of him providing his own religious service, like in contrast to theirs.
Yeah, and definitely you also feel that when we go back, you know, cut back into the Wicker Man, and you see him like pretty much curled up in pretty much the fetal position. He's that, and you see the sense of fear on Woodward's face, that the sense of Howie that. He knows he's going to die. He knows it's going to be a painful death.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, in reality, the point of like being burned alive is that the smoke, like the smoke inhalation, causes you to pass out, so you don't actually experience that pain. And of course, like being in that Wicker Man cage would mean that like you don't, you know, it's so much easier for that smoke to get trapped in there. But the way it plays out, yes, this looks like an incredibly painful death. But there's this nice little, like, very subtle thing, to the extent that I can't tell if it's just me seeing it or if it's actually there. But, like, right before he stands up to scream, you know, Jiju, you know, like, curls out of the fetal position, stands up to walk to the edge right before presumably dying, there's this, like, kind of flash of light white light right on him. So it's almost like there's a heavenly light brightening the space in front of him that he walks into. So he's almost ascending into heaven before he like screams in absolute pain. And I don't know if you've ever caught that, but that it's just a thing that, and again, it's just a thing that I keep seeing every time I watch it.
Yeah, that's something that I've not particularly caught myself. I think it could just be a blink and you'll miss it, but I've just happened to blink every single time.
Yeah. Or you know, it could just be that they're lighting it to just to show that the flames are right there. But it's just the way my brain is processing it might be what's causing that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely understand what they've seen that. Well, I know other films have shown like that, flashes of light to show like an ascendance into heaven, whether intentional or unintentional, like, thinking of like The Last Temptation of Christ and how a completely unintentional flash to why was used to end the film as a representation of ascension.
That's right. It was a fault inside the camera. It just happened at the right moment that Scorsese is like, yeah, we'll keep it. It's great.
Yeah, and it's also another, you really have to credit the sound design in this section of the film. It's how it's, you know, we mentioned all the songs competing with each other, and then you also get like the flickering of flames of as Wicker Man burns and the screams of the animals. Even though like the Red Summer Island presented this, you know, upbeat, they sort of celebration, it's those screams and the sounds of flames, it highlights that the horror of this scene. And for anyone inside the Wicker Man, you can probably just remove the images, just folk, and just hear the sounds, and you can imagine the horror of the scene.
It's so compelling, and certainly like watching it from the perspective of Howie at this point, because we're entirely invited to sympathize with him in this moment, especially like even if we're, you know, seeing him as this like kind of brutal authoritarian most of the time, because we're sort of like looking out at the Islanders from his perspective, and they all look like nearly crazed. You know, there is this intensity about them that feels like so impenetrable. There's no way that you could actually get through to them in this moment. And like being on the receiving end of that is just horrifying, which is why that final scene's so unsettling. Oh, go ahead.
And I think also this, well, again, I don't like mentioning it really, but I feel like the way it's presented here, I need to talk about how it's presented, like the Burning of the Commander presented in the remake.
Yes.
Whereas, like in this, like original one, Edward Woolley's performance feels like, you know, this accepting death of as much dignity as he can muster,
Yes.
whereas.
Yes, yeah, because he's going through all of these different emotions. It's defiance, it's fear, it's
Shock.
anger, it's shock, you know, like all of these different things. And from moment to moment, he's like shifting in a way that we feel like we can understand, but of course we've never been in that situation, so we can only guess that this is what that feels like. But it feels real. Whereas Nicolas Cage very rarely feels real in anything.
You
He's
feel
feeling.
that, like this one here in the remake, it feels like another Nicolas Cage freak out.
Yes, yeah. I mean, like, and admittedly, if I'm going for a Nicolas Cage freak out, I'm gonna go to Mandy, because that was incredible. But I have to admit, I really enjoy the remake for all the wrong reasons. It's a ridiculous film. But I read an interview with Nicolas Cage a couple of years ago, and they were just like, "Which film of yours do you feel like was unfairly critiqued?" And he said, "Oh, The Wicker Man. I'll stand by that." And basically, the interviewer was like, "Really?" And he says, "Yeah, like the only problem is it didn't turn out the way Neil LaBute and I wanted it to. Like originally, my character had this massive handlebar mustache, and if we could have kept that, the whole thing would have made total sense." So,
I mean, granted, I do want to see Nicolas Cage with a massive band on my mustache.
yes, totally. But yeah, no, it's the remake is just a mess of a film, and for the longest time, I was convinced this was Neil LaBute making a statement about what a bad idea making remakes is. But I don't think anybody would necessarily fund him to do that. But yeah, it's that whole ending, of course, you know, the remake ending is iconic in its own right because of, you know, the bees, because it's just so ridiculous that it sticks in your memory. Whereas, you know, the original sticks in your memory for all of the right reasons, because of the contrasts between Howie and the Islanders, because of the really strong emotions that are pulling you through that final sequence. I mean, it stands absolutely as just this, you know, really deeply impressive and significant film ending in British movie making.
And yeah, I think the way I can like describe like the way the different versions play out is like as I've mentioned before in this podcast, the original feels like it's funny on purpose, the remake is funny accidentally.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, totally.
And it feels like the remake, it wanted to try and capture that dark humour of the original, but it's maybe just be a sense of difference between the American sense of humour and the British sense of humour, or the time difference between the 70s and the mid-2000s, but for whatever reason, it doesn't work intentionally. It feels like it's funny accidentally.
Yes, yeah, I know what you mean. Like, no, there are some elements where you can tell that there's like a dark sense of humor working like behind the scenes, but none of it ever seems to add up. And you know, if you sort of think of it as, you know, this is a film that was meant to be like really darkly comic and weird and unusual, and then the studio comes in and goes, ah, we don't get it, let's make it more palatable, and then nobody likes it. That makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, it feels like, yeah, they wanted me to be really offbeat, but then like, the studio wants to make it more like a Platinum Dudes remake.
Yeah, because if you like put it within the context of those Michael Bay, you know, produced remakes of the 2000s, yeah, like there's an exaggerated quality to it. All of the themes are totally on the nose, but it's still like fails in every single important. Yeah, I know what you mean.
I think another like way to see the differences between like the different tones of the film is actually with the final shot of the Wicker Man itself and how it's presented. So I was in the original. It's also with just the direction the head falls. It's like in the original, the head falls backwards to reveal the sun, like sunsetting. In the remake, the head falls forwards onto the camera.
Yes. And, yeah, the camera mounted on the ground looking up at the Wicker Man, and it just like falls right onto the lens. There's this like kind of nice dramatic finality to it, but it like the camera stays sort of looking at the, you know, the wicker smoldering right above it for a while. It's sort of, it's like the whole like blood on the lens thing you'll get like during that period where like it'll break the fourth wall very briefly. It kind of feels like that's what it's doing, but the dramatic heft of it is undercut by all of the silliness of the film up to that point.
Yeah, I don't think it feels very abrupt as an ending as well with that shot. Whereas with the original, you know, it falls backwards, you get the shot of the sun, and then the credits play over the sun setting.
Yes.
Which, it feels like to me, adds to the ritualistic feel of this full section of the film. Like, you know, we've seen throughout like the film at this point, we've seen the sun get lower and lower in the sky in the days, and this having the credits play over the sun setting feels like a natural way for the film to end.
Yeah, and that like that beautiful like two trumpet like piece of music that Giovanni writes, I think it's just called Sunset, like over those credits are, you know, like sad, mournful, like partly triumphant, but also like tragic at the same time. So the music that goes with it just like really helps to like facilitate those emotions that were like so justifiably earned during that ending.
And yeah, I also have to give massive props to the cinematographer for Mitch for getting that shot.
Yeah,
and I just have to praise like the what a time when the British weather system was cooperative with the film.
Yes, I mean if there, you know, if there is a sun god, clearly like it was looking favorably on this film at that point.
Because yeah, I think I've read that you know, there are plans to do like a blue screen composite and try and recreate it if the weather wasn't cooperative. But they managed to get the right weather conditions at the right time so they could get that shot of the head falling off backwards to reveal the sun and get that shot of the sun setting for the credits.
No, that's right. And I think that like they didn't even plan for the head to fall in that direction. I think they kind of hoped it would, but it wasn't really up to them once it's on fire. But yeah, I remember, like, I think the version I read was very similar to yours, where they're just, like, shooting all that they can in the, you know, in Dumfries and Galloway. And, you know, the moment that the weather looks like it's going to work for that day, they're just like, right, we're doing this scene now. And Woodward hadn't properly, like, rehearsed his lines, but they were just like, this is no time. You got to come out and we got to do it now.
Yeah, I say, given how bad the weather was for most of the filming, yeah, it sounds like when you've got any chance of the weather being in the right conditions, you take it. Yeah, you have to, otherwise. Because in burning a mass giant Wicker Man, I think they had like two or three different versions of it, But there's pretty much no room for error. You have to get it right the first try.
No, absolutely. Because, you know, yeah, you've got the really big one that Woodward was in. I did my pilgrimage there last year just to look at all the sites. And, yeah, you've got the really big one that Woodward was in, which is in one place. And then, like, farther down, the stumps that still exist, and they're very tiny now, the stumps that still exist are part of, like, the shorter one that they used to film that final shot so that they could face it, like, towards the sun as needed, and to make sure that it wasn't, like, if something happened with the really big one and it didn't quite work, then, you know, they needed a backup. So they used that. And the remaining stumps are from the short one, whose head you see fall over right at that end. And again, like, sort of being able to, like, get all of those different setups and then to get that one perfectly is you know, they certainly tried to cheat chance a little bit, but there's only so much you can do with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something where if you've got trying to give as much margin for error as you can, but knowing that there's only so much leeway you have and only so much resources and budget you have to make the different models.
For sure, yeah. But like, it really is something going there and like seeing those, like, you know, where that one was, and you know that that's not the one that Edward Woodward was in, but you know that like a really key piece of film history was here, and it's this gorgeous location. Even though I went on a very, very clear day, there were no clouds, it was like I left the day before May Day from my version. I don't know if I meant that intentionally or not. You're like, when you're right there on the cliffs and the sky is really clear, you can actually see land just in the distance. And even then it feels like the end of the world. Like it feels like you're just right there on the edge. There's, you know, it feels like there's nothing around, even though you're technically on a campsite. And you know, the cliffside is gorgeous and dangerous. And I did the walk from there, all the way up to St. Ninian's Cave, where they, you know, sort of do the sacrifice, the ale to the sea, and they bring Rowan out of the cave, and that walk is tremendous, but it's much longer than the film makes it look. about a 3-hour hike or something like that. But yeah, this is just this beautiful like part of the country.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I mean, I talked about it in like the second episode of how like you've seen the locations and knowing that they are actual real places in Scotland and places that you can still go to. It adds that, creates that extra feel of it, believability of the film there. You can feel this, like the sense of, you know, what you're seeing is real. It's a real community, and it doesn't feel artificial. Like, that's nothing where with the remake it feels more artificial, it feels more like soundstagey to me, even though I know there's a lot of exterior shots, but it doesn't quite capture that same feel that the original does.
There were no sound stages involved in this film, I don't think. I mean, unless it was at some of the earlier scenes maybe that were cut appear in the what do you call it, the director's cut, is that what it's called? I think some of those might have been soundstage, but even then I'm doubtful. But all of the Summer Isle stuff, like locations were inside and outside, you know, houses and you know, real areas around Dumfries and Galloway and Plockton and you know, like Killeen Castle and things like that.
Yeah, it's one where, like, it's, as that you feel of what works for folk horror is knowing that they're real locations. It's, for me, it adds a bit of an unsettling vibe, is you can get that feel of it being, you know, close enough to, like, mainland Scotland on population areas, but isolated enough there, you can see, you can feel a changing atmosphere between like the mainland and Summer Isle.
Yes, yeah, and they did a fantastic job of that. And of course, part of that is like, you know, communicated in that, you know, in the beautiful opening credit sequence, which, you know, starts the theatrical cut, but comes after that, like, kind of opening in the final cut of you know, the seaplane sort of, like, you know, taking off from the mainland and then, you know, sort of flying over the countryside. Again, like, you've got music there thematically playing it out, where you've got this, you know, like, kind of traditional-sounding Scottish, like, bagpipe music set against a Robert Burns poem, and then into another Robert Burns poem, but played in a kind of a folk rock style as he enters that airspace. But some of that land was apparently footage that was filmed from over South Africa, I think, on Anthony Schaffer's plane. I believe it was something like that, but I do know that, like, some of that, like, flying over footage was South Africa, which, like, completely gives it this, like, clear, different feel to the mainland, and, like, as though you're sort of entering this, like, magical, new, strange area of Scotland that, like, nobody goes in or out of. Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's definitely one where, you know, even no matter where it was filmed, it's having that, you know, different locations and that stuff. It's, and yeah, it's just works well and help create that unique atmosphere to the film, and also highlighting that you're being accessible only by, like, seaplane or long boat rides, whereas you know, the remake, remember, right, it's like just a standard ferry you get, or like, I know he gets like there's ferries and seaplanes, but yeah, the original, you feel, you get that greater feel of isolation in the original compared to the remake for me.
Doesn't he have to bribe the guy that takes the post from the mainland to the island to get there, or something like that at one point?
If I'm remembering it right, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that a few times, and I keep forgetting huge chunks of it because it just, you know, all, like, falls into this massive mush of a melange in my head of weirdness and Nicolas Cage overacting.
Yeah. But then even, like, think of other folk horror films, like, recent years, that's, you know, have, trying to create similar vibes in the ending, you know, stuff like the end burning scene in Midsummer.
And
it's a thing where, even like, as much as I like Midsummer, they just feel like none of them quite catch the same visceral feel that The Wicker Man does.
No. I mean, like, I love Midsummer, and I think that ending works incredibly well, and I think it's doing, like, lots of interesting thematic stuff underneath. But, like, that whole time, you're not, like, with the person inside the burning hut. You're with Florence Pugh's character, who's basically having to watch all of these representations of, like, this life that made her miserable, and watch it all go up in flames. So it feels, like, joyous and triumphant, and there's a darkness to that because, you know, you're feeling, like, kind of happy about death, which is kind of the brilliance of that. But in terms of, like, putting yourself in the position of feeling this, like, kind of, not just the viscerality of you know, being burned alive in a wicker man, but being, like, faced with this, you know, community that is, that thinks that what they are doing to you is a good thing, and then aligning you with these animals that you're surrounded by that are screaming in fear and pain, and the booming sound of the flames as well, like, all of that has this, like, really visceral impact. You know, it makes your body sort of sense all of these different things happening at the same time.
And yeah, then also, I think of, compared with Midsummer, the like way that the other like residents presented on us and besides the main character, like Florence Pugh in Midsommar feels like her having a bit of a breakdown and coming as a bit of accepting being part of that ritual, that community, and it feels like she's being indoctrinated, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
Whereas like in The Wicker Man, there is that some disconnect and contrast between Howie and Summer Isle, and it's again what makes it a bit more visceral is what Howie would have been hearing them celebrating and the cutaways that we see them the residents smiling and doing that bit of dancing, and it just makes it feel all the creepier to me that they're viewing it as this positive thing.
Yeah, and Christopher Lee's like really exaggerated face is almost grotesque in contrast to everything that's happening. In fact, Christopher Lee's great, especially like sort of starting from the procession onward, because he just keeps becoming increasingly, he keeps appearing more powerful as he goes, and then by that point his face is like distorted in this rictus grin of ecstasy, which is actually explained in the novelization, which I've read a couple of times, I have to admit as well. In the novelization, that point in the previous scene where, you know, he and Edward Woodward are facing off, and he says, you know, if you kill me now, then no less than, you know, the Lord of the Island will be the best sacrifice. And in the book, Lord Summer Isle hears this, has to, like, process the fact that this is probably true, and then, like, put on a sort of a very strong leadership face while all of the rest of the residents are starting to question themselves and this decision. So he has to like take on this mantle of leadership to make everybody feel okay about this decision when that statement from Howie has actually struck a nerve with them. So like in the context of the book, Christopher Lee's expression in that ending is that exaggerated joy trying to get everybody else on side to
a mask
join in. But of course, like, there's not enough context given for that in the film, and it just feels like this moment of like climactic grotesquery almost.
That's something I do think about something when I watch it, is that how is he trying to convince himself that this is right cause and it's going to bring the cross back, that is going to work.
Yeah.
That he had that for him. It not only does he want to work for him, it has to work.
Yeah. And one of the things I find like really interesting about this is the way that like class is sort of playing into this, because you've got you've got Howie, who like this entire film, you're almost like finding him uncomfortable and brutal, and you're sort of on the side for the most part of these islanders who are just sort of going about their daily life, getting on with their religion, which they quite enjoy, makes them very happy. And it feels like this guy's just bullying these, you know, poor islanders for a long time. But ultimately, in the end, the person that wins is the rich aristocrat with like generational money going back to the Victorian period, who's bought this island and all the people on it. And he's basically murdering a cop for his own ends, and he knows he's going to get away with it. So like these dynamics like are often like very sort of smoothly looked over, because you just sort of see it as like this cop that's burned by islanders. But when you sort of like think about this aristocrat that's like pulling the strings on all of it and getting away with it, is amazing. And the only thing that like suggests possibly some comeuppance is that maybe the crops won't go this year and he'll get burned next year. But we don't know, because the film ends just as the Wicker Man falls.
Yeah, and I think it works that it ends at that point. I know there were like plans for a direct sequel.
Yes, yeah, and have you read the treatment that Anthony Schaffer wrote?
Yeah,
for, yeah, with where Howie's saved by eagles and everybody turns old overnight.
And Howie saying that he was aged from stress to justify bringing back Edward Woodward.
Yes, yeah, yeah, and of course, like, all of that fits in again in the book. The novelization of The Wicker Man, the book actually starts with Howie bird watching. So he's a bird enthusiast, and he's got his fiance out there watching birds with him, and she's bored out of her mind and wants to have sex with him. But he's just like, nope, no sex, we're looking at these birds. But that pays off if we get to the sequel where the eagles come save him. it's very interesting. And also in the novelization, you find out that it's Summer Isle himself who's been following and spying on and investigating Howie from the mainland, because it talks about this mysterious figure wearing these American high top shoes that sort of like looking at Howie from the shadows. So, you know, by the time Summer Isle turns up later wearing those same shoes, you're just like, oh, okay, it was him doing that all along. The novelization is fascinating. I don't know if I recommend it. Unless you're just like really curious to dig into this story and all of the possible approaches they could have taken.
It feels like to me, as I've not read the novelization, what stuff you described, it for me, it feels like it takes away some of that ambiguity and unsettling feel, knowing it more, having that be more explicit.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing I love about this movie, is the amount of ambiguity that's built into it. You know, how much of this is planned, how much of this is show, how much of this is authentic ceremony. To what extent could this plan have totally fallen apart? If Howie had, say, given in and had sex with the landlord's daughter, like, would they have probably still burned Rowan Morrison? Probably, you know, but we don't know. They read the, in one of your earlier episodes, somebody pointed out, the book he's reading in the library says, the community leader will remove the still warm skin and, place it over himself like a mantle and parade through the streets. And like, that's the thing that terrified me the most on, after like revisiting it, because I totally missed it the first time around, but revisiting it, I'm just sort of like, oh, that's gonna happen after the credits go, but we don't see that. I just have to imagine it, which is horrifying.
I don't think a lot of times horror this type works through not showing stuff. There is a place for horror that's more explicit in showing everything, but for me, I'm a person who prefers that horror of the unknown.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I've done a lot of work on slashers and slasher films, and a lot of those, particularly the later ones, are very much show don't tell, show and tell and don't suggest. But like some of the more effective ones for me, like going back to Friday the 13th, have these sequences where there are deaths that you just don't get to see. You don't know exactly what happened, but there is, like, you know that death has happened, and the fact that you don't know how or why or what happened afterwards is enough to, like, make that unsettling. And I think that this is a film that really thrives in that area of unsettling, because on the surface, it could be a musical. It could be a mystery, like almost like an Agatha Christie type mystery. It could be a sort of dark comedy drama sort of thing. But the unsettling nature of all of those ambiguities, and there's only one death in the film, unless you count the animals as well, which you know probably should. there's only one human death. Related to a horror film, you usually want a high body count. just the fact that there's one human death, and it's at the very end, and it still manages to construct this creeping sense of dread and fear and horror while still being really funny and quirky and unusual, is a testament to how successful it is.
Yeah, and yes, and stuff. I know, you know, heard stuff like some producers or the streeters were wanted an ending where it's like a heavenly rain to save Howie, or
yeah,
like that, or that just stuff that would like lead into the sequel.
Sure, but, yeah.
And but for me, it does. It wouldn't work. It would rob the film of its power, its unsettling feel, its, you know, its importance in the horror canon if Howie lived.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's bad because, like, having read that that Schaffer treatment of Wicker Man 2, like, there's some interesting ideas in there, and I like the fact that it's displaced to, like, the Harvest Festival. But at the same time, it's just like, okay, it's this all over again. Whereas there's not enough to really justify undermining the heaviness of that and the finality of the original's ending.
Yeah, it's, and yeah, something of it, you know, and that's, yeah, having lived and that and stuff, it's, yeah, if how he lived, it just, yeah, it just wouldn't have the power. It's so, whole thing of having that power is having, for lack of a better term, versus some real, you know, like, quote unquote, win, but then there's that uncertainty, that feel of, have they, you know, if their eyes, they think they've done the right thing, but, you know, yeah, is it going to bring the props back? Is it just, as I've discussed in previous episodes, more likely, the crops lands in fertile because they've been over farming it?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, you can sort of leave it up to the gods, and really Christopher Lee, Lord Summerisle is banking on this being a one-off good, you know, good year, to save himself by that end. But it's still so uncertain. And as you say, like, there's the complete likelihood that they have over-farmed the land that wasn't even, like, prepared to grow stuff to begin with. Yeah, it's very interesting, and I love that all of this is just kind of left up to you to decide what's gonna happen.
Yeah. So yes, yeah, I think that's good to end it. So before we finish, is there any other point you want to raise on the film or is history of it in general?
This ending is such an important piece of certainly British film history, which kind of like makes the whole film valuable in its own way. One of the things I talk about in my forthcoming book is the fact that, like, this is a film that's both thought of as a cult classic, but also a legitimate, like, British classic. And I kind of try arguing that, like, they're not mutually exclusive. Like, the things that make it a cult classic also make it appealing as a significant film in its own right. So, yeah, I love this movie, I think this ending, you know, for all of the different adjustments and changes that the other cuts make earlier on, needs this in order to really deliver that satisfying feeling that you need from a film, as much as, like, there's so much still left unanswered.
Yeah, I feel like there's still questions you've asked, it's still stuff unanswered, but it, again, I said earlier, it's a film that's more rewarding the less you know, the more uncertainty you've got.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that Robin Hardy sort of messed up with on The Wicker Tree. There was a little bit too much answered, and he doesn't quite get that sort of comedy, like, dark comedy seriousness tone. He never balances that out again after The Wicker Man. He did like directed two more films, The Wicker Tree and The Fantasist, in the mid 80s, and he wrote one called The Bull Dance that was directed by somebody else, and none of them feels quite as satisfying or well balanced, as much as like they sort of strain the sort of blending of those genres. He has a really hard time not going so to such absurd lengths. He can't resist going into that sort of area of absurdity, which undercuts all of the seriousness, where I think that Schaffer's scripts like kind of helped him keep things balanced well enough.
Definitely think of The Tree. Yeah, it feels like it is that balance between Hardy and Schaffer that makes like their collaboration with each other that makes the original work so well. There's like the Wicker Tree was all Hardy, and it doesn't have that balance that Schaffer brought with the original.
Absolutely not. And even like, you know, the input that, you know, Peter Snell as producer was putting in, and even Christopher Lee, who was sort of like signed on very early on. You know, I think all of those contributions, you know, while you can say what you will about sort of making art as a committee, sometimes, you know, if you get the right committee to balance out somebody who has inclinations to something really unusual, all of those things can balance out to something really interesting. And I think Robin Hardy is one of those that like kind of needs somebody to collaborate with him to help him get the best out of his frankly unique sensibilities, which I don't dislike, but I don't think they work sort of as a singular voice.
Yeah, and definitely feel like that collaboration is needed. Like Ben Schaffer, Christopher Lee, even like Paul Giovanni as well.
Yeah.
It feels like all those interacting with each other, playing off each other. That's what gives the film a lot of its power.
Sure, yeah. And even Anthony Schaffer's brother, Peter Schaffer, who was a very successful playwright at the time, had some input very early on. And I think this is just a really fascinating blending and even conflict between creatives that like made this film the once-in-a-lifetime thing that it is. I don't think, you know, anybody or any group of people could quite recreate what this is and has been.
Yeah, exactly. It's truly one of a kind piece of like filmmaking, and even like other folk horror, the remake, Wicker Tree, nothing has ever been able to capture the unique brilliance of The Wicker Man.
No. I mean, even within like all of the other folk horror films that, and many of them really brilliant and interesting that came out at this time, this is one of the few that still stands out as this like really like key highlight of that particular movement. And I don't know if I want to call it a movement, but you know what I mean, like that type of filmmaking. And I think it's for a good reason. It is just so special and fascinating and unlike anything else.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think that's sort of like one point to which to end this episode and indeed this whole podcast discussion of The Wicker Man. Thank everyone who's been listening to this throughout the full 18 weeks that I've been doing this. Maybe I'll come back sometime soon, do like episodes on other folk horror, maybe do ones on The Wicker Tree, the remake, essentially like Paul Giovanni's Sherlock Holmes play, Charlton Heston adaptation of it. But for the time being, this is the end of the podcast. And yes, thanks to everyone for listening. Wickham, before we get going, is there anything that you want to promote?
I'm a basically a film critic, scholar, and author. I'm, as I said, my forthcoming book on The Wicker Man for the BFI Film Classic series will be out next year in the autumn, should be 2024. I've written a book on the Friday the 13th franchise called See, Hear, Cut, Kill, Experiencing Friday the 13th, Edited a couple of books, such as Style and Form in the Hollywood Slasher Film and The Bible on Screen in the New Millennium. You can find all of those at Amazon very easily. And I also, you know, recently made a film called A Possible History of Ghosts, which I'm still trying to find the right platform to show online, but it's been to a few festivals. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. And for me, you can find my main review site over at reviews.wordpress.com, and you follow me on social medias on Twitter or X's, where I apparently have to be calling it, but it's still Twitter. I'm not falling for Elon Musk's bollocks. So yeah, follow on Twitter at Tony Coogs, and then on Instagram at Coogan Tony. And okay, I'd like to thank you again for guesting on this episode.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed the podcast very much.
And to everyone listening, thank you for indulging me with my ramblings on this brilliant film. And goodbye.